Today, lies, half-truths and misdirection. The DFA Dailies for the 23rd of June 2021. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to Active Posts, covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. In today's show, we look at the lies people tell when getting a loan, the New South Wales government half-truths about housing in the state, and the misdirection from the Fed. Oh, and more bad news for the crypto crowd as Bitcoin ducks below 30,000 US overnight. Is more pain ahead? But first, brokers and banks might be being lied to by clients on their credit applications, according to a new study from Experian, in which they revealed that one in five Australian borrowers embellished or omitted salient details on their loan approval forms, particularly in the personal loan and credit card space. A further 60% said they didn't understand how loans were assessed. We conducted this on Australian borrowers to understand their thoughts on the current loan approval processes and to get their honest view on what's going through their mind when they're applying for a loan, in terms of sharing the completely accurate picture of their financial position. Matt Dimitriou, General Manager of Decision Analytics at Experian, said. We uncovered some interesting findings, the headlines of which are that one-fifth of Australians admit to telling white lies on their credit application. I think the reason for that is that there is a feeling that if they disclose the complete pictures, it might hinder their chance of approval. The common white lies that were confessed were around understating living costs, another around existing debts and investments, and overstating incomes. They were interesting findings, but at the same time probably not overly surprising. We did see a lot of this that came out in the back of the Royal Commission a couple of years ago. Clearly, we're seeing a few of these things continue, despite the banks being more arduous and scrupulous around addressing and assessing consumer affordability, he said. Now, I have to tell you that that is partly true, but it's also the case that there is an air of desperation among firm consumers to try and get credit at any cost. And so that's another reason, given the uncomfortable situation that many people are in. Now, their study comes as politicians are debating responsible lending obligations, the rules that govern how banks approve customers for credit. Given that 20% of applicants might be misleading banks, it could factor into decision-making regarding responsible lending. But on the other hand, my view is that people need to understand that banks have a responsibility too. It's a mutual obligation. It's not either or. Taking away responsible lending would be a terrible decision at this stage in the game. It's a two-way street, said Dimitriou. The banks were perhaps a little bit lax in their processes around accurately qualifying this information, but at the same time, there is an onus on the consumer to present a true picture to the lender. There's longer-term issues if that doesn't happen. It's problematic for the lender if customers go into hardship, but it's also very troublesome for the consumer if that occurs. One of the issues right now in a buoyant credit market, where the home loan market is frothy and there's a lot of FOMO going around, and if you're a young family trying to get your first property who finds themselves getting knocked back at auctions consistently, you might become a bit desperate, he said. That FOMO ends up with you stretching the truth a little bit, which is troublesome because if interest rates increase over time or we see greater inflation, living expenses will increase and you're in a precarious position. There's an obligation on both parties, and income verification isn't that exact. Some consumers, when applying for a loan, might look at their expenses and see them as luxury items, eating out, for example, expensive gym memberships, and might believe that once they have a loan and increased financial obligations, these are the sorts of things that they'll compromise on and sacrifice. By the letter of the law, they should be included as part of the application and processes. Those are the types of things that get understated. CBA recently changed their home loan assessment rate, a key factor in how they decide which loans are accepted. It's a very competitive market. With limited differentiation in the mortgage space, said Demetriou, CBA are taking a pragmatic approach, and others are doing the same thing. There's more pressure on them on the back of the Royal Commission and increased responsible lending obligations. It should be a standard practice to have a strong buffer, and in a record low interest rate environment, it's more important than ever. And just make one point, if I may, that the RLOs, the responsible lending obligations, came in many years ago and haven't really changed. So I don't understand his comment about stronger RLOs. In fact, the responsible lending obligations have been pretty static since the global financial crisis. And as I will continue to maintain, the concept of removing obligations from lenders and putting all the onus on the individual borrowers is just nuts. The New South Wales government has announced that it is setting up a regional housing task force to address housing supply shortages, and it's released its 21-22 budget. The Minister for Planning and Public Spaces, Rob Stokes, made the announcement at an Urban Development Industry Association luncheon and said that the government's current focus is on creating, quote, new greenfield housing supply. Mr. Stokes said the task force would report back in September 21 on how the New South Wales government would better utilise the planning system and other levers to increase supply. Oh, here we go again. More supply-side issues. It's not a supply-side problem that we've got. We've got a credit supply problem. Too much credit driving house prices too high. The New South Wales government also announced that more than 18,000 new homes have been earmarked for immediate rezoning in Sydney's southwest in a bid to boost housing supply in New South Wales. Thousands of dwellings have been rezoned in the Glenfield precinct, Lowe's Creek, Maryland, Leppington 2 and 5, and Wilton Town Centre precinct, along with playing fields, open spaces, primary and high schools, parks, environmental conservation land, and employment land that could support jobs, the government said. Commenting on the focus on increasing housing supply, Mr. Stokes said it's clear that as a result of the pandemic, demand for greenfield housing has increased even more than anticipated. So we are responding with new housing in some of Sydney's best growth areas, the southwest and the MacArthur. Housing supply is not just important in Sydney, but across our regions, which are experiencing strong growth as we bounce back from drought and as more people are working flexibly and remotely. That's why I'm setting up a regional housing task force to report back by September on how we can better use the planning system and other levers to boost supply. Speaking about the new task force, the Deputy Premier said that a new approach was required to support regional residents with new housing supply and make regional towns a magnet for people coming from the city centres. From Byron to Bega and Coffs Harbour to Dubbo, regional towns are booming, but in many parts of the state, planning has not kept up with growing demand, he said. Regional housing markets are complex and unique, and there could be a whole range of factors driving housing constraints, and we need to unpack those so we can deliver new housing opportunities in our regional communities. The New South Wales government also released its budget for 2021, in which it's predicted that annual house price growth would peak around late 2021. The budget paper said as higher prices encourage more owners to sell, this will work to limit house price growth over time. In addition, higher prices are expected to price out more potential buyers, weighing on demand. And the budget papers also predicted that macroprudential tightening by regulators in response to growing house prices is unlikely because of the concentration of lending growth in owner-occupied loans rather than investors. Although this would change if speculative investor lending was to increase significantly. A major intervention would prompt a downward revision in house prices from baseline with broad implications for the economic outlook. And it added that residential construction is expected to remain strong in the very near term, fueled by higher house prices, ongoing fiscal and monetary support, and low interest rates. New South Wales households lodged over 23,000 applications for the Home Builder grants, of which more than 16,000 were for new dwellings. That's equivalent to 32% of all building approvals in 2019, according to those budget papers. And it also said that demand for renovations is expected to drop off in 2022 as discretionary household spending is redirected back towards international travel once the borders reopen, while housing activity is expected to ease once the temporary boost to housing construction and renovation activity from the Home Builder Scheme fades. Business investment in aggregate is expected to contribute to economic growth over 21-22, but the end of tax incentives beyond that period could constrain investment growth after 2022-23, the government said. However, it added that this was expected to be more than offset by the improvement in economic conditions. And the New South Wales budget includes $852 million in capital expenditure to deliver social and affordable housing and capital upgrades across New South Wales through the New South Wales Land and Housing Corporation and Aboriginal Housing Office. According to the budget papers, this has continued the government's $812 million COVID-19 social housing stimulus package, which was announced in 2020, including $366 million in 21-22. And the government said that it expects this package will deliver 800 new houses and upgrades to around 16,500 existing properties across the LAHC, AHO, and community housing portfolios from 2021 to 2022, along with accelerating housing estate redevelopments, which would contribute to the delivery of over 500 new social housing dwellings and 1,000 new land lots for sale to build private homes. And it said this was an addition to the government's $1.1 billion Social and Affordable Housing Fund, the SAHF. The government has also announced the expansion of the $57 million Together Home Programme through the Department of Communities and Justice, which it said would provide support through additional leasing and wraparound services for 250 households for 2 years and support more than 100 dwellings in the community housing provider sector. The budget papers also noted that the New South Wales government released a consultation paper in November 2020 outlining a proposal for a phased transition away from stamp duty for people buying a property, who would instead be able to choose between paying a large amount of stamp duty and land tax where applicable, or a small annual property tax based on unimproved land value. The government said in the budget papers that over time the reform, which is particularly aimed at first home ownership, could improve housing affordability, increase home ownership by 6%, increase average household income by around $3,300, and create 70,000 additional jobs. Hey, it's magic. The government released a property tax progress paper on the 11th of June 21, outlining the findings of the consultation and providing more information on topics frequently asked through the consultation process. The government is committed to putting forward the best possible model to create the most effective tax system for the people of New South Wales, the paper said. Comments on the progress paper, received before the 30th of July 21, will help to inform the government as it considers its next steps for property tax reforms. In the budget speech, New South Wales Treasurer Dominic Perriott said, "We're progressing our property tax proposal because we know housing affordability is the challenge of a generation and we want young people to get a foot in the door. Today we introduced legislation to reform infrastructure contributions and it will unlock housing supply faster and more efficiently and make homes more available and affordable. We're advancing reforms to deliver a more streamlined planning system to get more houses built faster and more affordably." Now, over in the US, markets remained upbeat overnight amid mostly dovish Fed speak. Fed speakers included Chair Powell's testimony to Congress, where he reiterated familiar themes such as transitory inflation. Williams repeated his expectation the labour market has a long way to go before normalising. Daley said the economy has not yet normalised. And Maester said the FOMC is not yet ready to reduce accommodation. But Ray Dalio, the billionaire investor and founder of Bridgewater Associates, which is the world's largest hedge fund, took note of the topsy-turvy reaction across financial markets last week to the Federal Reserve's signal that it could begin to lift rates sooner than investors had expected, and that policymakers had started to discuss the eventual slowdown of its monthly asset purchases. The yield curve flattened violently, with short and medium-day yields rising sharply last week as long-term yields fell. The dollar soared, and equities ultimately slid, although growth-orientated shares outperformed. Dalio, speaking in a conversation with economist and former Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers at the Qatar Economic Forum, warned that it would be difficult to avoid an overheating of monetary inflation due to a flood of bond issuance. With US deficits set to rise, the country will have to sell a lot of bonds, he said, to investors who hold bond inventories with negative real or inflation-adjusted inflation rates, he said. This comes at the same time that Chinese capital markets and other capital markets are becoming more attractive to global investors. That creates a supply-demand situation that can bring monetary inflation because there will not be enough demand to buy those bonds, he said. As a result, the Fed won't be able to taper or cut back on its own purchases of bonds and may have to actually step up those purchases to prevent interest rates from rising, he said. And the world's number one crypto, Bitcoin, was on the verge of erasing its year-to-date gains on Tuesday after briefly slipping below a psychologically important level of 30,000 US. At the last check, Bitcoin had actually bounced back above it again. But it did hit a low of $28,814, which marked its lowest level since around January this year. Bitcoin is nursing a year-to-date gain of under 4%. Equable Goodham, Vice President of Transactions at Ledger, said that a pullback in crypto was inevitable given the run-up. Any asset class that sees a meteoric rise in the same way as we've seen in crypto is expected to correct, he wrote in emailed remarks. He said that China's intensified crackdown on crypto, including bans on mining and trading, has only amplified the downside. That said, he believes the underlying fundamentals of the crypto asset world have not changed. Sean Rooney, head of research at crypto asset manager Valkyrie Investments, said that the ban on crypto activities in the People's Republic had forced mining operations to shift to other areas outside of China, which was one of the most active areas of Bitcoin mining, and that this may take a while to resolve itself. Recent regulations in China have forced many Bitcoin miners to pack up and look for alternative locations, he wrote. And he said that the decline in crypto could be lengthy and pronounced. The drop from a high of almost $65,000 is now down well over 50%, signaling that Bitcoin traders could find themselves in choppy waters for weeks to come, Rooney wrote. Nick Mancini, research analyst at crypto sentiment analytics provider Trade the Chain, said that at least part of the decline in prices for Bitcoin is due to mining operations being forced to sell their stock of Bitcoin to offset the costs of closures. The market is currently being inundated with supply as Chinese miners have been selling their crypto to cover the costs of shuttering operations, he explained. This is having a negative impact on all prices, with altcoins being the most impacted. Mancini said that savvy investors may want to watch Bitcoin for increased order book interest in the $20,000 range, suggesting that it could fall to that level, signaling a possible reversal in hand later. To be sure, there is no one-size-fits-all model for investing in crypto, and buying is dependent on investors' tolerance to losses and their long-term perspective, strategists noted. In fact, of course, it's hard to call this an investment at all. It's a speculative bet, in my view. Nicholas Corley at Daily FX wrote that those downturns aren't uncommon in crypto, but said that recent investors may be more inclined to hold on for an uptrend given the recent crypto collapse. We've seen those moves before, and it's likely we'll see them again. If you believe in cryptos and are a holder, your exit strategy has just been pushed further into the distance, he wrote. If you believe, it's a religion. Crypto watchers have said that the sector tends to operate on four-year cycles, which begins with euphoria, followed by a crash, and ending with a persistent period of languishing prices. That has been the case thus far in 2013, 2017, and this year's most recent moves. Declines for crypto came as the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 0.2%, the S&P 500 was up 0.51%, and the Nasdaq was up 0.79% to a new high. So indices were trying to recover from those withering sell-offs last week. Some strategists have speculated that the drop in digital assets also have been fueled by a rotation out of crypto and into traditional equities. But as Bloomberg points out, one of the most reliable trades in cryptocurrencies has gone awry. Bitcoin futures, which typically trade at a premium to the spot price, have collapsed along the curve amid a brutal sell-off in the world's largest cryptocurrency. That's obliterated what's known as the basis trade, in which a trader would buy Bitcoin in the spot market today and sell long-dated futures, locking in the discrepancy between the two prices. It's a painful watershed for one of the crypto market's most ubiquitous plays. Hedge funds piled into the trade, which could previously reliably produce double-digit annual gains. Even better, the arbitrage was virtually risk-free, given that the CME Group is the counterparty. However, the trade existed because long-dated futures were more expensive than shorter-dated ones, given that Bitcoin is inherently scarce and theoretically should rise, a structure known as contango. The breakdown of that dynamic implies that built-in bullishness has disappeared gradually as prices declined. That's the very simple explanation, that contango is typically indicative of bullishness in the market, and so to the extent that market participants are pessimistic, it makes sense to me that it's broken down, Nick Carter, founding partner at Castle Island Ventures, said. It could mean that some capital has been structurally withdrawn from the market. We have been in backwardation for the past few days. This is due to the current market turmoil in the spot market, said Wilfred Day, chief executive officer of Enigma Securities, which works with institutional and corporate clients to provide crypto services and bespoke liquidity solutions. As leverage futures and perp traders unwind their positions to meet margin calls via auto-liquidation mechanisms on exchanges, the futures have traded below the spot. This could persist as long as sentiment remains negative and deleveraging trades continue, he said. Contango and backwardation are names for curve structures that map traders' guesses about what a given contract could be worth in the future. Contango means upward sloping, while backwardation means downward. Bitcoin on Tuesday, amid a decline that reached 12% at one point in that session, briefly wiped out all of its 2021 gains. And the drawdown comes amid negative sentiment about its energy use, brought on largely by Tesla's Elon Musk, as well as a clampdown from China. The coin is now trading not far below the levels it started the year at, which was $29,000. The basis trade's disappearance is the latest surefire crypto wager to backfire. The Grayscale Bitcoin Trust swelled to a shocking 40% premium to its underlying holders in late December amid a rally in prices and relentless demand for crypto exposure. Institutional investors were able to capitalize on that by depositing Bitcoin with Grayscale in exchange for GBTC shares, then selling those shares at a markup after 6 months lockdown period. However, GBTC's premium dissolved in late February, and the fund currently trades at an 11% discount to the Bitcoin it holds. The curve is just flat, and these kinds of opportunities have gone away, said Stephanie Coulette, chief executive and co-founder of FRNT Financial, whose firm says it offers the world's only regulated BTC basis product. The futures curve is saying that it has no idea where the market is going. So let me just pause here and highlight again that we are seeing the rise of financial derivatives linked to a volatile underlying Bitcoin. And therefore, there is really no underlying sense here. People are taking volatility positions. People are trading based on the hope of future direction. But there is really very little underlying value. And remember that there is no underlying value to Bitcoin other than market sentiment. So this, I think, is a very important point to remember. it is not in the same class as some other assets that at least do have some underlying value. This is linked to something else. Bitcoin is all sentiment. It's all religion. It may still go a lot higher. It may not. But remember that the moves are being exacerbated by these derivative trades. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.